All right, these are the stories that I think you should know about today. Israel gets a travesty of riches in a deal that gives Palestinians nothing but the ability to continue breathing, I guess. Maybe. President Trump admits publicly that when it comes to Israel, money buys influence and even access to the Oval Office, unannounced, if the person wants to walk in. This is a remarkable admission, by the way, by the president. And a blockbuster report. Boris Johnson was paid $1.3 million to kill the Ukraine war peace deal. So say documents leaked to The Guardian. This is a Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're going to begin today with deals. Two of them. One that could have been, and one that was just completed. One that seemed fair to both sides, and one that is anything but fair to one side. See, when it comes to the, quote, peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, I don't even have to tell you the score. But in case you don't know, let me describe it to you. One side has agreed to stop exterminating the other side, and the other side, those who are being exterminated, it's an ugly word, but how else to describe it? They have agreed to stop being exterminated. That's the peace deal, in a nutshell. Its one-sidedness is of almost biblical proportions. It is a great deal for Israel, right? Good for Israel. Signed, sealed, and delivered on a silver platter by the President of the United States, who is now, by the way, more popular among Israelis than their prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu.
People of Israel, please know that America joins you in those two everlasting vows, never forget and never again.
Amazing. It was crazy. You would think Elvis was in the room or Frank Sinatra or something. So Israel got every single thing that it wanted, aligned with its goals, both past and present. More land, what they've always wanted. Fewer Palestinians, what they've always wanted. And no guarantees that the Palestinians will ever be a self-governing nation, something Israel has never given up. Oh, and they get to continue doing operations in both Gaza and the West Bank, which means the killing could possibly continue tomorrow. You see, if might makes right, then for Israel, man, this deal is mighty right. And it's especially right for the people who gave or give money to the United States, especially right for Mr. Trump's top Zionist donors, namely the Adelsons.
Got $60 billion in the bank, $60 billion. I think she's saying no more. And she loves Israel, but she loves it, and they would come in, and her husband was a very aggressive man, but I loved him. He was a very aggressive, very supportive of me. And he'd call up, can I come over and see you? I say, Sheldon, I'm the president of the United States. It doesn't work that way. He'd come in with the... But I actually asked her, I'm going to get her in trouble with this, but I actually asked her once, I said, so Miriam, I know you love Israel. What do you love more, the United States or Israel? She refused to answer. That might mean Israel.
She gave $100 million to the president. Her husband gave him $200 million for his campaign. What, $300? Some say more total. Wow. Imagine how you would feel if you're an American and you're listening to that. It's hard to hear that and not take note of a few things. First, the absolute infatuation and celebration of money and what it's like to be ridiculously rich, and laugh about it. The admission that a man who gave the president hundreds of millions of dollars for his campaign maintained throughout his life, he passed away, unequaled access to the White House. He could walk in when he wants, said the president, without having to call. And it's okay also we took from this comment, for the term America First to be absolutely nothing but just a slogan.
This took 3,000 years to get to this point. Can you believe it? And it's going to hold up, too. It's going to hold up.
So the president leaves Israel and he goes to Egypt. That's the signing ceremony right there that you're watching in Egypt, strategically orchestrated to give the appearance that Arab countries are signing off on the deal. Give the appearance. Key words, right? So you're probably wondering, why Egypt, right? Well, every year, the United States gives Egypt billions and billions of dollars from the money paid by U.S. taxpayers, who get absolutely nothing back from Egypt in return, right? They give, they get nothing from Egypt. Nothing. Now, it's estimated Egypt has received more than $50 billion. I think that's an underestimation, but those are the numbers I found today when I was researching this. That they've gotten that money, $50 billion at least, since the 1980s. Why? To remain pacified and agreeable. It's a great deal. Great deal for Israel. Not so great for U.S. taxpayers. Now, as you watch these images, I can't help but feel moved. I feel good for these people. Good for them. Families coming back together again. Can you imagine what they've been through? 20 Israeli hostages and their families that have been caught up in this 50-year-old grudge match. As well as, by the way, the families of the 2,000 or so Palestinians. They were jailed and facing life sentences. They were also released as part of this exchange. But then one also has to ask, why now, right? The exact terms of this deal were on the table under both Biden and the Trump administrations. Right? Same deal. Both times it was turned down. Exact same deal. Nothing new was essentially negotiated. Nothing new was done. It was just a matter of this time Israel was ready to say, okay, we're done. We're going to stop killing Palestinians. And we're ready to move on to the next phase. Exactly what that phase is, by the way, and what it's going to bring. I'll tell you what history says it's going to bring. More of the same. So that was the deal that everybody was talking about, and rightly so. But there's another deal that I should tell you about as well. There's another deal that's in the news, one that could have been, and one that also seems to prove that so often with these deals like these, it really is all about the money. All right, let's start with this. See that guy right there? That's Christopher Harborne. Remember his name? He's one of the UK's biggest and most private political donors, a multimillionaire with a holding company that profits from war. And by the way, that does not make him unique. A lot of people do that. But his particular stake in these companies that manufacture things like military contracting equipment, who supply, by the way, robots and drones to Ukraine. Keep that in mind. That's important. So, if there's one place in the world where robots and drones have become increasingly relevant, even necessary, it's where? Altogether, Ukraine. Exactly. You've been watching the news. There, the fighting has gone on for almost 4 years, and that tool has been necessary. But there was a moment where this fighting in Ukraine could have ended. It could have stopped. April 2022. That's when this guy, Boris Johnson, walks into the picture. Walks into Kyiv after getting word that Russia and Ukraine had agreed to the deal terms to end the war. Great news, right? Oh, my God, they're finally going to agree to the war's end. Even Vladimir Putin said, I'm ready to sign the deal. Told Tucker Carlson that. And has said it since. Well, apparently it wasn't good news for Boris Johnson, who, according to countless credible reports and eyewitness reports as well, told President Zelensky, do not sign that deal. Do not agree to stop the war. Walk away. Continue fighting. That's what he was told. Since then, I and many others have been asking ourselves, why did that happen? Why did Boris Johnson suddenly, of all people, walk in out of the blue and decide to fly into Kyiv and kill this potential peace deal? Why? Why did he do it, right? Who knew? Well, remember the guy I told you about a little while ago, this Christopher Harborne guy, the multimillionaire donor? According to leaked documents acquired by The Guardian, Harborne traveled on several occasions with Johnson to Ukraine. He was, according to records, there with him on at least one trip. That was in September of 2023. But in that trip, interestingly enough, he was never identified as a donor, nor were his ties to military contractors disclosed. Instead, and according to The Guardian's reporting, he attended high-level gatherings, government gatherings, and was identified only as an advisor to the office of Boris Johnson, making him sound like he was a lowly assistant or maybe a secretary or something like that, right? Not that that's a lowly position, in case you have that. So, but it leaves me to ask, right? So why the mystery? Why the lack of disclosure? Were they trying to hide something? Aha, good question. There's more. According to the report, Harborne wrote a check to Boris Johnson's company for $1.3 million. That company was set up by Johnson after leaving office as the prime minister as a way of trading on his contacts to get global business, you know, money. Those deals were written about in The Guardian in a series of reports. It's called The Boris Files, by the way. I looked at them. Interesting reporting. But this deal, the one we're talking about now, the one with Harborne, it seems particularly questionable because it makes us ask, right? Did Boris Johnson take $1.3 million so that contractors could continue to make money selling drones to Ukraine? Was that his cut for prolonging the war? Is that why he suddenly flew into Kyiv to meet with Zelensky? And why did Zelensky agree, by the way? Was there something in it for him? A sweetener, perhaps? See, these are the questions that are now being asked, questions that no doubt deserve answers. But it does not appear that those answers are going to come from Boris Johnson. When asked, you know what he does? He takes a page from the same playbook often used by other Western leaders over and over and over again. It's the old Russian propaganda response. So here's what former Prime Minister says when asked by The Guardian directly about his relationship with Mr. Harborne.
Your pathetic non-stories seem mostly to be derived from some illegal Russian hack job. You should be ashamed of yourselves. Why don't you just change your name to Pravda? Your stories are rubbish, and you are doing Putin's work.
It's always Putin's work when you don't agree with something that is being reported or you don't want to challenge the facts, right? By the way, I checked. The leaked files have absolutely nothing to do with Russia or Russian intelligence or any other country for that matter. Those leaked files that I have been telling you about that $1.3 million and the connection with Mr. Harborne, they were disclosed by a group called the Distributed Denial of Secrets. It's basically a group, a transparency group, and they're not based anywhere in the world like Russia or anything like that. No. They're based in the United States of America. All right, to discuss this, I'm going to take you live now to Alexander McKay. He is the co-host of Decline and Fall. Great show, by the way. I've been watching many of his recent episodes. He talks about something that's important because Decline and Fall is essentially a way of saying what the hell is going on in the West, and in particular in Western Europe. And that's why we have him on, because he's the perfect guy to be talking about this situation with Boris Johnson. I got to tell you, I was like Alexander, thrown aback when I saw this report. It just seemed almost dreadfully obvious to me that they would do something like this. And I guess this reporting has been available for some time. And the Guardian seemed to do a pretty good job presenting it, at least to me. What is your take?
Well, Rick, it wasn't a surprise to me because Boris Johnson is already notorious in Britain for being one of the most corrupt prime ministers that the country's had in recent years. And that's up against a lot of competition. He was almost bankrupt by the time that he became prime minister due to an expensive lifestyle and an even more costly divorce. So even more than other prime ministers, Boris Johnson was exposed to, the temptations of corruption. And therefore, it shouldn't be a surprise that he had a very dubious relationship with Christopher Harborne and a number of other high-profile donors who contributed to him financially and also in other ways, such as providing him with free holidays. So Boris Johnson should be regarded as essentially a criminal who occupied the office of prime minister and who used it for his own personal gain.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this guy Harborne was using him to try and get the war to continue so he could make more dough off of it?
Well, I think the likes of Harborne are businessmen, and businessmen don't invest lightly. They invest in assets that are going to bring them a return. And Boris Johnson, in his role as the officer as prime minister, was an asset to be invested in because, of course, he controls ultimately a gigantic budget, which can be funneled to various different interests that this gentleman Harborne has, including significant shareholdings in the arms company Kinetic. So there's no other reason to invest in Boris Johnson other than the return that you would get from his decisions. And the war in Ukraine promised to be an immense moneymaker for the British armaments companies, as well as other technology companies. And one should really ask what Boris Johnson's commitments are here, because he goes on and on about his commitment to Ukraine and defending Ukraine against the evil Putin. But the Ukrainian people have been sacrificed here in huge numbers, so that a few people in the West can make money, including the likes of Harborne and Boris Johnson. So it's a very dirty game that has been played here, Rick.
I'm not sure if there's a quid pro quo. I'm not a lawyer. So based on what I read and what I saw so far that has been reported, it seems to me there's a clear connection between these two, and there's a clear connection between the action that took place. In other words, you get a check, then the action is you go to Ukraine and you stop something from happening. Is that enough, you think, within the legal structure in the UK to possibly warrant an investigation or even accusations or beyond that, charges?
Well, it should be. But unfortunately, Rick, British politics is a very, very dirty business. And Boris Johnson would not be alone in engaging in such, shall we say, dubious relationships with very rich businessmen. Now, Johnson, as I said earlier, has been investigated for corruption on multiple occasions, and he's always been found to have been behaving improperly, but not illegally. But the questions, if Britain was the democracy that its leaders like to shout about, if it held these high standards, which British prime ministers like to go to other countries and say that they should be held to, then Boris Johnson should be investigated for his links to Harborne and other businessmen, because it seems that there is a direct, a personal gain element going on here via Johnson's relationship with Ukraine and via the continuation of a war that has cost Ukrainians and Russians so much in terms of human life. So whereas he should be investigated, it is unlikely that he will ever be investigated, because the entire British political establishment is heavily invested, both financially and politically, in the continuation of the NATO war on Russia. And they're not going to do anything that could get in the way of that, I'm afraid.
You know, I was scouring through some of the Boris files, interesting reporting that was also done by The Guardian, where they established that since he left office, he's been using his position and his contacts to be able to make money. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. You use what you know to create a business so that you can feed yourself and your family. Other people have done that. The question is, How do you do it? And with whom do you do it? And as I was looking about through this reporting and some of these other deals that Boris Johnson has looked into or actually done, I found that he's not very scrupulous about who he does business with. I don't think he really much cares whether it's Ukraine or Venezuela or Mali, or it's just he seemed to be looking for opportunities. That was my read. What's yours?
I think Boris Johnson is, as I said, a very, very corrupt man, and also a man who loves money and has a lifestyle which his bank balance can't cover. That makes him particularly unscrupulous. But in that, he is unfortunately not unique. British politicians for many generations now have fostered relationships with various different, very shady regimes, such as the Saudis, the Gulf states, etc. In fact, if you observe some British government documents about the way that they maintain British power around the world, it's actually based upon the relationships with just those kind of regimes that the British government seeks to keep what it has lost in terms of the influence through empire by building relationships with regimes that are dubious in terms of human rights, in terms of corruption, in terms of lack of basic legal processes. This is standard for a British politician because this is the way that the British government does business now. It's through influencing operations. It's through behind-the-scenes deals. It's through payoffs out of the sight of any government regulation. So in that sense, Boris Johnson is unfortunately absolutely typical for the kind of people who run Britain today.
Yeah, and it seems like oftentimes they're making money off of wars more than anything else, and sabotages, and other conflicts, et cetera. You know, I've read several reports that lead me to believe that much of what has happened inside Russia, the blowing up of the Crimea Bridge, for example, some of the actions taken in against the railroad, for our example, that happened recently not far from the Ukraine border, the assassination of generals in Moscow in their homes or leaving their homes, that much of this was taken on by MI6, for example. And with knowledge of the British government, I mean, that's a hell of a thing to do to a country that has nuclear power, no less.
Well, this is the British way of war now, Rick. This is not just speculation either. This has been reported on by outlets such as The Grey Zone, and my co-host of the Decline and Fall show, Kit Clarenberg, has reported on this. The British no longer have the muscle, shall we say, to do things themselves militarily via direct confrontation. They couldn't hope to directly take on the Russians on the battlefield. So they seek to do it via other means. They have been, I would argue, the leading influence on the creation of the post-2014 Maidan coup regime in Ukraine. They have been the leading influence in its the creation of its sabotage and terrorism operations inside Russia. And they have been the leading influence in pushing for more of these to happen. And what you find with the British government is it'll engage in things like assassination, bombing campaigns, sabotage operations. And if they get into trouble, they hope they can run behind the American colossus for protection. Because this is the way that the British have done things since at least the Suez Crisis of 1956, which is they all continue to be as aggressive and belligerent as possible in the hope that if the Russians decide to extract some sort of vengeance, that they can run behind the Americans and say, please, President Trump, save us from the vengeance of the Russians. The risk about this is that eventually American politics may evolve to a point where the American president either finds it not advantageous to himself to defend the British or finds that it's simply not worth the risk. And by taking these risks, by always seeking to leverage American power for their own interests, the British are playing a very dangerous game that will eventually, I think, catch up to them and will render this way of doing business too dangerous to continue.
Well, I'm an American, and I can tell you right now, I don't understand what we as Americans gain from the Brits anymore. I think there was a time when maybe it was that, there was something, other than, you know, many of us spend our honeymoons, like I did, in Stratford-upon-Avon and other places, and it's a beautiful country, and it's really cool to see the castles and all that. But actual fruit that we bear from this relationship, am I missing something?
Well, there's still a lot of money that goes between the City of London and Wall Street, Rick, so that's part of it. But what the average American gets out of this relationship is, of course, exceedingly little. This is a relationship between, like, the elites in Washington and New York and the elites in London. And it's not something that the average Briton or the average American will get a lot from. It's also a big risk for the United States to have this loose cannon off the edge of Europe, running around Russia, blowing things up, and then never taking responsibility themselves for it, but always hiding behind NATO and ultimately hiding behind the United States, because they are unable to fight their own battles anymore, because they not only do they lack the resources to do it, but also there's stunningly little support amongst the British population for strapping on a gun and going off and fighting Russia directly. Nobody wants to do that. And so the British, the rulers of Britain, have to rely on terrorists, mercenaries, and other dubious characters such as jihadists in Syria, jihadists in Libya, fascists in Ukraine, to do the dirty work for them, because nobody in their own country wants to go off and die in Donbass anymore. Hmm. And so this way of war, which is essentially turning Britain into a version of the, shall we say, the later period Venetian Republic, which had to rely upon mercenaries to do a lot of its fighting for it. This is a very corrupt, very dangerous regime that exists in London. And the sooner it is dismantled, the better it will be for the people in Britain and also the people in the United States and the rest of the world, because its legacy now around the world is one of violence, subversion, terrorism and corruption. And that's not something that is particularly positive for anybody who's exposed to it.
Yeah, and it seems like there's not that much difference between, you know, a Blair or a Johnson or a Starmer to me. It almost seems like they're, you know, cut from the same cloth, willing to do just about everything except, and I hate to say this, but as far as I can tell, help the people of the UK. I mean, wages are lower than ever. Inflation is as high as ever. Social resources are down as much as ever. I mean, you know, you go down all this GDP growth is horrible. You go, by the way, approval ratings. Last time I checked, Starmer was some like 23%. So that in and of itself, without looking at anything else, tells you what the people think of the guy who's supposed to be leading them. So what the hell is going on? Do they all just not care about their own people?
Well, they don't, in short, Rick. This is a country which is run by people who are dedicated to finding other areas of the world to exploit and make money in, and not investing in Britain itself. As a consequence of which, over the last 40 years, most of the British industry has been asset stripped and destroyed. The profitability of like the big British companies doesn't come through investing in Britain. It comes through sending money overseas and finding places to hyper exploit over outside of Britain. Meanwhile, in this country, we've got a housing crisis, increasing homelessness. We have it's increasingly difficult to sustain any kind of small business in this country. You have record amounts of personal debt, record amounts of government debt, and none of the political class in London has any clue as to what to do or any inclination to change this model that they've been following for many decades. And as a consequence, like, people in Britain loathe the politicians and all of the politicians in London more than they ever have done before. But again, no change ever seems to come, because it is not just the politicians that exercise the power. You can elect a prime minister, but in reality, there is a permanent state in Britain that resides in the bureaucracies, that is run from the private clubs in London, that is run by whispered conversations in smoke-filled rooms between rich men and senior government figures. That's where the decisions in Britain get made. They don't really get made in Parliament. they don't really get made even in the office of the Prime Minister. They're presented to the Prime Minister, and if he's like Keir Starmer, he'll say, yes, sir, and go and do it. So until we dismantle, like, where the institutions that actually wield power in this country, which is not Parliament, it's not the elected politicians, it's the people behind the scenes, people like the man you opened this segment with, Christopher Harborne. That's where the power actually lies, and he can buy the politicians and get the decisions made in his interests, whereas the rest of the British population is left with no influence.
What a wonderful pantomime. You just brought us right back to where we started this, which makes me even want to ask more questions about what it is that these guys then do to try and change things, if anything. And if they don't want to change things, then I have to ask, where's the media, for example? It used to be one of the best in the world when it comes to good, pure journalism, some of the best newspapers in the world, some of the best reporting in the world. Where are these people? Are they all dead or drunk?
Well, I think for the newspapers these days are mostly owned by politically connected monopolists who are dedicated only to defending their particular bit of the current political establishment. The state broadcaster, the BBC, is, well, it is a state broadcaster, therefore it largely does what the state says. The rest of what's referred to sometimes as civil society is under very strict legal limitations. You can be arrested in Britain today for instance, holding up a sign, drawing attention to the British government's complicity with the actions of the State of Israel, for instance. You can be harassed by the police for doing something like questioning the British government's role in the Ukraine war. My co-host of the Decline and Fall show last time he came into the country was detained for several hours without being arrested, simply because he'd written critical articles about the British government's role in Syria and in Ukraine. This is the kind of place that Britain has become, not just under Keir Starmer, but also under Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, David Cameron, in fact, going back a long, long time. It's a place where you can be harassed by the authorities simply for having a different opinion. And if that opinion becomes too well-known and people come to know certain inconvenient facts that the government doesn't want them to know, then you'll be harassed and intimidated into silence. That's what British democracy has come down to these days, a tiny clique exercising power. And if you try and go against that, then they will turn the forces of the state on you.
It sounds like the KGB. Sounds like the old Soviet era. Isn't that crazy? I mean,
well, it's a more subtle kind of like authoritarianism that most people in Britain don't see from day to day. But the moment that you step out of the very tiny space that they allow for so-called debate, then they'll find various different ways to harass you. They'll remove your access to banking facilities, for instance. They'll have your means of communicating taken away from you. I mean, this is why they want digital ID cards now, Rick, because it's just another means by which the government will hit you over the head with their hammer, so to speak.
Well, so by the way, what you've just described is very much similar to what we call in the United States the deep state. A lot of people call it the administrative state, the people behind the people that you elect, and they seem to be more powerful. Seems like the same, right? Is that pretty much what you're describing?
I think it's very, very similar, and we should bear in mind that the development of like the secret systems that govern the United States has been very much interlinked with the development of the same structures in Britain, which is that there's been a lot of influence both ways in terms of the construction of a power that can be exercised regardless of elections. I mean, this is something that the rulers have been concerned with for over a century, which is how do you maintain the defense of your interests when the population is able to vote? How do you stop an elected government essentially being able to threaten the interests of the most rich and the most powerful in the country? And the answer is you put power in bureaucracies so that no elected politician can affect that. You do the decision-making in the aforementioned smoke-filled rooms, and you make sure that the politicians themselves are deeply compromised. So, for instance, Keir Starmer is, I would argue, a deeply compromised individual. Boris Johnson, a very compromised individual. The former President Joe Biden in the United States, an incredibly compromised individual. The more compromised they are, the more they'll get promoted. Because in essence, the easier they are to control, the worse stuff they've done, which is why you end up with some of the worst people in the country running the country, because if their secrets were ever to be revealed, then they would have some severe personal and legal troubles. So this is the nature of the system, I would argue, in Britain, in the United States, and in Western Europe as well. There's no real difference now in terms of how these countries are actually run.
That's fascinating, that way you describe it, and I'm glad that you have such a handle on it. Have you been affected by this somehow? I hear horror stories of people who are just trying to tell the truth, and they are visited, we might say, or they are let known that somebody is watching over their shoulder based on what they're saying. You're definitely cutting against the grain in the UK. Have you had any repercussions?
Not so far, Rick, but as I said, my co-host has had the legal repercussions, which is why he doesn't live in Britain anymore. But it's something that you are always looking over our shoulder for, because I know people, I'm connected to people who've been arrested for, again, holding up a sign, a handwritten sign. I know people who've been arrested for attending entirely peaceful protests. I've attended their trials in the local courts. And these are, of course, political trials. So it's something that anybody who dissents over a long-term period and has and starts to build a public profile, eventually we all reach a point where the state will start taking action against you. And it's something that you have to expect if you get into this line of business, essentially. It's a risk for all of us now, because the British state has decided to crush dissent using its legal system.
Do the Zionists control your politicians the way they own ours?
I think that the connections between the British establishment and the Zionist movement go back a very long way, Rick.
Yeah.
If you recall, like as early as the 1880s and 1890s, British politicians were backing the Zionist movement in order to set up some kind of colony in what was then Palestine, now the State of Israel. And therefore, the connections run very, very deep. And again, it's like with the hostile policy towards Russia, you have complete continuity between various different British governments over the attitude towards the question of Israel and Palestine, which is that the successive British governments have used weasel words to say that, oh, well, we back a Palestinian state, but look at the policies, which is it's consistent. They run spy flights overflying Gaza from the RAF bases in Cyprus. They provide crucial arms components to Israel. They have Israeli officers in Britain for military training. So it's completely consistent. For all the weasel wording about the need for a Palestinian state, Britain is up to its neck in the blood of the Palestinians. The British government certainly is. And they are as guilty as Biden and as Trump in terms of the genocide of the Palestinian people. And again, this is the reason why they banned the peaceful protest group and direct action group Palestine Action. It's the reason why they prosecute people. It's the reason why they try and intimidate people, because they don't want the truth of their relationship with the State of Israel and the long, bloody history of that truth to be known to the wider population.
How do you control the people? I mean, the British people are smart. They're some of the most educated people in the world. And it's a pretty good educational system in that country. How do they keep them down like this? How do they keep them believing in fairy tales and only hating the countries they're told to hate and liking the countries they're told to like? How do they do that?
I think there's several different levels this operates on, Rick, which is that, first of all, there's a lot of propaganda that you get as a British person from birth about the exceptional nature of Britain, about the need to defend the great legacies of the British Empire. That's part of it. Monopolization of the media systems is part of it. The power of like the BBC and the other major broadcasters is part of it. But I think also the great majority of the British population, as you indicated in the previous question, Rick, are becoming poorer, are becoming less able to enjoy any kind of decent life. And they're principally stressed out about money, monetary concerns, about whether they're going to be able to pay the bills for the next month, about whether they're going to be able to keep a roof over themselves and their families' heads. And when you've got a situation where, like, a huge percentage of the population is just concerned with whether they're going to be able to see the next month, basically, in terms of being able to financially survive, that tends to put people in a situation where they don't pay attention to the broader issues. They're just looking at that bank balance, just looking to get through another few days. And that breeds a certain demoralization, which enables the political establishment to get away with all kinds of things. But I would just add this to it. Eventually, there will be a bill to pay for the political establishment in this country, because if you make you create a situation where the population is barely scraping by, when the crisis hits, and the crisis in the British economy is very much brewing now, Rick, and it's coming, when the crisis hits, there will be hell to pay for the politicians, because people know, they might not feel like they can do anything about it now, but they know that they've been stiffed for a very long time, and they know that the politicians might not have the power, but they're the ones with their heads on TV. And they're the ones out there justifying this stuff. So there will be eventually a bill to pay for them, because, again, like, the British economy is in a very fragile state. It is an entirely non-productive economy now, based on transferring money and speculation. And when that falls, due to the colossal debt, partly, that it is in, there will be an enormous political repercussions in Britain itself, as there will for the rest of Western Europe as well.
You know, I think there's nothing more important if you're ever honored by people who choose you to represent them, to make every decision based on what those people need and how whatever decision you make will affect them. But, man, I am just finding that that's not the case anymore. It's not the case in the United States. It's not the case in the UK. It's not the case in France. It's certainly not the case in most of the Western European countries. I see more of that in the countries I was taught to hate, like Russia and China and all these other countries. I find there that there's more of an alignment between the government and the people than there are in our countries that we grew up in the West. Am I crazy?
Well, no, it's clear that in the East now, in China, Russia, and other countries of a similar nature, the non-imperialist countries, I would say, that there is a far greater degree of care for the welfare of the people than there is in places like West Britain and France and Germany these days. And that's because, I would say, principally, that these are nations which invest heavily in their own country. They invest in their own industries. They invest in bettering the lives of all the people in their countries, much more so than Britain does. All that the British government is designed to do is to take money out of Britain and invest and find a profitable return on it elsewhere, meaning that there's less and less industry in this country. There's less and less productive industry. What you've got in Britain and France and Germany and, of course, in the United States is more and more just an economy based on just speculation and rent seeking and the creation of gigantic amounts of debt. That leads to a degenerated political culture and, more broadly, a degenerated culture, which is where it's essentially like the something for nothing society starts at the top.
Yeah.
And it just filters on down. And that's why you end up with this sickness that a lot of Western countries are going through, which is that the establishment and the ruling cliques don't care. Their money's elsewhere, out of the country. As far as they're concerned, if Britain or France or Germany or the US falls into the sea, well, we'll just go elsewhere. Because they other than the passports, they have no real connection with the lives of the great number of people who live in these countries anymore. Mm-hmm. To them, it's just another place on a global, chessboard, which they're playing on. And if there has to be sacrifice, well, so be it.
You're such a smart guy, Alexander. I really have enjoyed this conversation. You get it. You and you're so able to articulate what the situation there is now. Is it too late? Do you think there's a way of salvaging the situation for the people of the UK? Not for the government. I don't give a crap about them.
Yeah. I think there is a way forward, Rick, but it would depend upon two things. It would depend upon the coming to power of a government that would actually have a program that would challenge the ruling forces in Britain. And not only that would challenge it, but would be capable of seeing it through. Hmm. So as soon as you got a government in that challenged the 1%, shall we say, or the less than 1% who actually exercise real power here, they would do the thing that they always do, which is create panic in the markets, declare that the economy is going to collapse, try to collapse the economy in actual fact. To which any politician, if they wanted to be serious about being able to enact their program, would need a counterbalance. You would need to mobilize the people in your support. You need to tell the people the truth, which is that we as a nation would have a choice. Do we allow ourselves to be held hostage by a tiny number of parasites, or do we enact a political program that will actually rectify things? And to rectify things in Britain, we would need to do things like dismantle the power of the biggest City of London firms, dismantle the power of like the unelected and unaccountable people we've been talking about, and also to restore our relations with other countries like Russia, like China, would be to give up the way of doing business that the British government's been engaged in for so many centuries now, which is then to start relating to China, Russia, and other countries as equals, not as exploiter and exploited, but as equals. And as equals, we could have a very decent relationship with these other countries that could help us rebuild all the industry that we've lost and rebuild our capacity to produce things. And that would be a relationship which would profit for the British people as a whole, not for the tiny number of parasites like Harborne and others who actually run things in their interests. So the way forward involves giving up the way that British leadership has done things for so many centuries now. It requires giving up the dreams of empire and giving up things like NATO and giving up illusions like the British nuclear program, which we all know, by the way, is controlled by the Pentagon anyway. So it means doing business in a fundamentally different way. And if we do that, then there's no reason why we can't actually go forward. But if we keep sticking to this model, then the country will metaphorically, if not literally, sink.
Alexander McKay, well said. Wow. What a delight having you on our show, The Sanchez Effect, to have this discussion. Tell people again a little bit about yourself and where they can reach out to you or catch you.
Well, I'm the co-host of the Decline and Fall show. I present this every week with my friend and co-host, Kit Klarenberg, who's based out there in Serbia. We do an analysis each week of the big stories around the world that typify the quite literal decline and fall of the Anglo-American empire, because that's what it is. It's the empire that the British started and then persuaded the Americans to take over the management of. And everywhere we look, we find signs of its decay. And of course, the title is a deliberate play on the old Edward Gibbon book, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So that's what we do each week. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on YouTube and Substack. Come check us out. All kinds of interesting stories on there.
Excellent conversation. Thank you, Alexander. Really enjoyed it. Look forward to talking to you once again.
Thank you, Rick.
Time to look now at our mailbag, and we get a chance to talk to you, get a chance to hear what you're saying on my interview with Alexander Cristoforo and the lies about Iran. Yowie Joe writes, I'm watching and learning from Uganda. Thanks, Ya. Glad you're here for us. Political Research Steve is watching us from down under, and he says, Australian media do not report this type of information. Yeah, I know, in many cases. Thanks God, he says. Good work. You're right, Steve. Same as in the good old USA. They don't report and have the conversations that you just heard me have. Educate Yourself 204 agrees with Steve. He says, thank you for bringing the truth, Rick Sanchez. It's like everything was inverted and hypocritical, he says. I'm glad that I'm not the only one that sees this. I'm not watching mainstream news anymore, but I'm happy to watch your channel. Well, we thank you for being here, Steve. We're really glad that you're here, and we'll continue to tell it like it is. GTP Tech says U.S. and peace is like oil and water. I wish I could prove you wrong, GP Tech, but you're right. It is, at least right now. Priya Darshi is watching us from India, and she's not happy about the West. She says, quote, Why can't these people understand that India is an independent sovereign country and it's not run by the executive orders of the American president? Thanks for agreeing with us, Priya. I've made that point here and to my American friends, and some of them, I think, are starting to listen. For example, here's Emmett Brooks. He says, the NATO countries obtained their wealth from piracy and slavery. They're losing their colonies in the global south, and they're desperate. They're finished unless they can conquer and plunder new victims. Conquer and plunder has a familiar ring to it, doesn't it? Hopefully, Emmett, the gig is finally up. Well, if you've got thoughts that you would like to share with us, we'd like to hear them. So go to my YouTube podcast. It's Journalistically Speaking. Go there, watch what we broadcast, and leave a note, leave a message. Whether you like what we're doing or don't like what we're doing, it's all cool. I'm also on X, by the way. So just look for me there at Rick Sanchez TV. And look, thank you so much for letting us come into your home. And I'll be looking for you next time on The Sanchez Effect.